This is the Anderson Files on PodClip. The Anderson Files is a look at commerce, investment, economics, and retirement issues that affect each and every one of you. Your host is Mike Anderson, Executive Vice President, Retirement Services, and partner of Finestone Partners. Finestone Partners is an independent firm with securities offered through Four Point Capital. And now your host, Mike Anderson.
Generating income and investing in best of breed equities. With me today is Kevin Simpson, founder and chief investment officer of Capital Wealth Planning. Kevin has been portfolio manager of Capital Wealth Planning LLC since establishing the firm in 2005. Originally from Philadelphia, PA, Kevin has been investing in options and equities since he began his career at W.H. Newbold's Son & Company. He has also worked with institutions and high net worth individuals at Wheat First, Butcher Singer, now Wells Fargo, and Sterling Financial before establishing Capital Wealth Planning. He's a graduate of George Washington University. Kevin, welcome.
Hey, Mike, thanks for having me.
Thanks so much. To get started, what do you consider best in breed equities?
We look to invest in companies that we feel have taken great care of their shareholders through both good times and bad. And in large part, we measure that by how well they pay dividends and to what extent they have increased those dividends over time. So when we look at companies, we're not looking for companies that necessarily pay the highest dividends, but we're looking for companies that have a good dividend payout and a history of increasing those dividends for the right reasons, meaning that they've been increasing their earnings, and therefore they've been able to increase their dividend payout to shareholders. The other nice byproduct of an increasing earnings stream is that generally those companies will see price appreciation over time. So great companies, solid fundamentals, strong balance sheets, lots of free cash flow, ethical management, and a good product.
And Kevin, can these companies be over several different industries, from financial to consumer staple to healthcare? Is it across the industry spectrum?
Yeah, Mike, for the most part, when you're building a diversified portfolio, you're going to want to have inclusion across multiple sectors. The way we do it at our firm is that we have representation within each of the 10 traditional sectors. So what that does is it eliminates the possibility of market timing. It takes away the overweight or underweight of any one sector. We dig down even further to a maximum allocation to any one particular company. But more than anything, we believe in well-diversified portfolios. Unfortunately, each and every sector will typically allow you to find a couple high-quality, great companies.
I see your strategy includes covered calls. And before we get into the strategy, could you describe a covered call?
You know, Mike, that's the most often asked question when you're introducing any type of option strategy. One of the first things people think of is, boy, there's a risky strategy. I want to steer clear of it. But covered calls have the ability to reduce volatility, to reduce standard deviation. We use covered calls as a modest risk mitigation technique. The neat thing about it is that it has a cash flow byproduct, and I know we'll get into cash flow and income in a minute or two, but the easiest way that I've found to describe or explain what a covered call is I use the analogy of a lease option to buy in real estate. When we're selling a covered call, we're essentially selling someone the right to buy a stock from us that we own at a price higher than it is today. And it's that simple, just like a lease option in real estate. Someone's buying from us the right to purchase our stock at a price higher than it is today, to the extent that we write out of the money covered calls. So let me give you an example. If we own XYZ stock, Microsoft, Apple, we'll pretend they're trading around $100 per share. If we sell a covered call on that position, on that share of Microsoft or that share of Apple at this hypothetical $100 current price, we're selling, in our case, 30 days into the future. So we typically write covered calls on a one-month cycle. That's sort of our sweet spot. And then we'll go 4, 5, 6% higher than the stock's trading today. So we would be selling, in this example, a covered call for $105. And for that right, for that ability for someone to buy that stock from us at $105, they're going to pay us a premium. And we're going to keep that premium whether the stock goes up, down, or sideways. And if the stock goes down, well, we're never happy if the stock goes down, but at least we've pocketed a little premium. If the stock stays flat, well, we're certainly, again, kind of ahead of the game there. And then if the stock goes up, well, we've made some upside capture, some appreciation, and we've made that premium. Now, if the stock exceeds that $105 strike price over the next 30 days, let's say it goes to $108, then we're contractually obligated to sell it at the $105 pre-agreed-upon price. So the idea of covered calls is that you don't always participate in every bit of the unrealized upside, but it has a tremendously high probability of causing us to be successful investors without looking for those home runs.
Kevin, how do you think your strategy fits into an investor's portfolio?
I think we really represent a core allocation, certainly to the extent that we're an equity income manager. We focus heavily on dividends, heavily on dividend growth. The covered call part of what we do is a component of our strategy. It's not the leading part of the strategy. It's not the tail that wags the dog. We use covered calls very tactically, very judiciously, some could say even frugally. But when we think of where our portfolios should be positioned, we're going to own 22 to 27 large cap, blue chip, high quality companies with a dividend target cumulatively on the portfolio of between 2.5% and 3%, with maybe also as importantly, if not more importantly, a 5-year 10 to 15% growth rate on those dividends. And incidentally, 8 of the stocks that we currently own in our portfolio have increased dividends this year in 2020, which is sometimes just really hard to believe when you think about the landscape of where we are. But if we can generate 2.5% to 3% cumulatively on the dividends, with our covered call component, we're generally going to be able to bring in another 2.5% to 4% a year in call premiums. So together, we're looking at a 5% to 7% cash flow on a high-quality blue-chip portfolio that we consider a core large-cap allocation.
I'm chatting with portfolio manager Kevin Simpson of Capital Wealth Planning. I'm Mike Anderson, and this is the Anderson Files on podclips.io. Kevin, to continue, what sets your covered call strategy apart from your peers?
That's a great question, Mike, because first of all, there's not a massive number of managers that utilize covered calls as a cornerstone of their strategies. It's a lot of work, and sometimes it's a lot of inactivity. You know, we go through a process every day for every company that we own, looking for opportunities to write covered calls. And what makes us different is that in many instances, we're not writing a covered call on a position that we own all the time. And that is a lot different than our peer group, which tends to be much more systematic in utilizing covered calls. And that was the way I was raised. That's how I was brought up, which is we want to maximize and write covered calls on every single thing that we can to generate the most income, the most premium. And I would always push back and argue and say, if we're so good at what we do, if we're so smart, can't we just accept the fact that every single market environment isn't perfect for writing covered calls? In fact, I would go one step further and say there are lots of instances in which it can be somewhat counterproductive. And that would get a lot of pushback from my teachers and my mentors, but I would take it one step further and say, you know, if you play poker, and I hate using analogies of anything having to do with gambling and investments because there should be no correlation, but to the extent that you play poker recreationally, you're not going to go all in every hand. You're going to look at your cards and make a decision as to whether or not probabilities are in your favor to keep going. And I would take the covered call approach in much the same fashion to say sometimes it can be wonderful. The covered calls surely work best when we need them to most, when there's periods of high volatility, when things are scary, when markets are tumultuous. And there are other instances in which when markets are rising and volatility is very muted, that you can be executing too much of the forfeiture. You know, I use the analogy sometimes that I don't want to run out into a busy highway just to pick up a nickel. That's not worth it. But there are instances in which writing a covered call is worth it, where it was not running into a busy highway for a nickel. So most of it has to do with volatility. When volatility is higher, we tend to write more covered calls. And when volatility is lower and markets are on a smooth sailing trajectory upward, we tend to write fewer covered calls.
For the equities that are held in the strategy, what drives the sell discipline? When do you decide to sell?
Well, anytime you get a portfolio manager on the Anderson Files, hit us with that question. There's no question we dislike more than what's your sell discipline. On Wall Street, we tend to produce a lot of words and say very little when it comes to sell disciplines, but that's not the case with capital wealth planning. It's not the case with our strategy because everything we do is rules-based. We follow the three R's: rules, risk, return. One of the most important things in our strategy is our rules for how we sell stocks. And there's four reasons, one of which we've touched on already. If we write a covered call and the stock goes higher than the strike price, then we're contractually obligated to sell the stock, which would be a sell discipline. Second reason is good old-fashioned rebalancing. We want to own great companies, but we don't want to own too much of any one great company. So we have a rule that says we're going to have a maximum allocation of 5% to any one stock we own, no matter what our conviction behind it. And sometimes those stocks that we have do well, and they might appreciate and become 7 or 8% of our overall allocation. It's not a bad problem. It's a good problem. But if a stock goes up to a 7 or 8% weighting, we simply trim the excess to bring it back down to a 5% allocation. So essentially, once again, we're forcing a profit. We don't mind selling and locking in profits. And that's a second component to our sell discipline. The third is if a company cuts or suspends or withholds or drops a dividend. We want to own companies that have a history of increasing dividends. We're not looking for companies that are cutting or suspending dividends. So if that happens, we just sell the stock immediately. And the fourth reason, which is very company specific, very stock specific, is if we have a company that we own that is underperforming its peer group or its sector by 15 to 20%, we might not know why it's underperforming, but something behind the economics of that company has changed, and Wall Street knows something. So rather than sitting around waiting to find out, we just remove it from the portfolio. We can always buy it back, but what we don't want to do is we don't want to hold the stock to perpetuity to the downside. We have a very strict sell discipline. We can own a stock that's down 20%, and in 2020, from February 19th to March 23rd, pretty much lots of our stocks were down. Lots of them were down over 20%. That's not a reason for us necessarily to have to sell a stock But if we have something that's underperforming its peer group, then we remove it from the portfolio.
With this year and the pandemic rolling along around the world, has this led to selling certain stocks that you otherwise wouldn't have sold in let's say, normal times?
Yeah, I can give you a really good example. Boeing was a stock that we had tremendous success with for many years. Now, they went through a problem with the MAX 737 before we ever heard of COVID-19. But in late February, February 21st, the relative underperformance, the COVID-19 virus, the coronavirus, had made headlines. It was here. So we sold a big chunk of the position at $331 a share. A week later, March 6th, we sold the rest of it because it hit that maximum threshold for pain for our relative underperformance exit. We sold the balance of the shares at $260. But within a month, that stock dropped below 100 and cut the dividend. So I think that's an example of a stock that, all things being equal, we probably could have ridden it through the MAX problems as long as it continued to pay the dividend. But thankfully, we got out of it at a tremendously respectable level as opposed to kind of watching it go down. The other example that came to mind when you asked the question is one of my favorite stocks, which is Disney. And we own that very successfully for a long period of time also. And I remember it was a Thursday afternoon and we were on the analyst call and the company was going through all the challenges that it was faced with and continues to face. Difficult for Disney to make money if you're not going to theme parks or movie theaters or sporting events or Disney cruises. So they cut the dividend. They suspended the dividend. We immediately sold it the next day because we're not going to own a stock if it's not paying a dividend. Shares are still right around the same level as when we exited it, and I'm fairly certain that there'll come a day in the not-too-distant future when we own it again. Those are two examples in this calendar year where our sell discipline has kicked in. One with a stock that is relatively underperforming and then continued to do so. The second with a stock that suspended correctly for all the right reasons, suspended its dividend.
My guest is portfolio manager Kevin Simpson of Capital Wealth Planning. I'm Mike Anderson, and this is the Anderson Files on podclips.io. Kevin, when people think of options, they think they can be risky. Why would you disagree?
Oh, Mike, I don't think I would disagree. Anything can be risky, and options can be some of the riskiest things you can do with your money because an option has a definitive period of time. So if you're buying something and you're speculating, you can, in that case, you can lose all your money, and you can lose it pretty quickly. Many of us know people that would have still a sour taste in their mouth, maybe from having tried to trade options. So I think anything can be really risky. I used this kind of a joke earlier about running into a busy highway, but you know, crossing the street with your eyes closed can be risky. However, writing covered calls, the way we're involved with utilizing an option, we're selling the option. We're not investing in something. We're not speculating in something. We're selling an option. And when we do that, we're bringing money into our pockets. And no matter what happens, that money's ours. Again, whether the stocks are going up, down, or sideways after the fact, we're bringing in a modest income stream in a covered call writing process that actually reduces risk. It lowers your risk. It also, there's no free lunch in life. It's not a magic elixir or some kind of amazing strategy. The trade-off is you forfeit some of the upside. So it's a very conservative strategy. In our case, it allows us to participate in a lot of the upside, but not all of it. Far more importantly to us, it allows us to participate in some of the downside, but not all of it. Our clients tend to be retired or close to retirement. They tend to want stock exposure, but they want to do they want that exposure to have a little bit lower market risk. And that's what a covered call can deliver. It can modestly reduce some of the downside.
In an election year, how do you position your strategy, especially this year?
The easy answer, and it is the answer, is that it doesn't matter to us what's happening. We go through the same process. We engage in the same rules, regardless of what's happening. Nothing external is going to impact how we go through our process or how we engage in our investment strategy. Having said that, volatility is going to play a big part in when we're writing covered calls and to what extent we're going to be covering positions within our portfolio. The election, both in 2016 and 2020, were tumultuous, to say the least. Now, there appears to be a little bit less volatility heading into this election than there was in 2016. In 2016, we wrote a lot of covered calls in October because volatility was peaking. It turned out that the markets accelerated incredibly in November and December. So to that extent, we didn't get to participate in all of that surging rally the last 2 months, 2016. Today, as we sit here in October of 2020, we have only three positions with covered calls written on them. Volatility still seems a little bit higher in relative terms, but it pales in comparison to what we saw in February, March, April, and May. The coronavirus caused volatility to be heightened to levels we hadn't seen since 08 or 09. And in March and April of this year, we had most of the positions with covered calls written against them. And it turned out to be very, very productive.
Yeah, but what market conditions would you identify as favorable and unfavorable for the strategy?
That's a great question, Mike. The markets that I deem to be the most unfavorable have little to do with whether or not it's a good market for covered call writing. When markets go down, I always think that's unfavorable for any of us who are invested in stocks. The best type of market for someone who's engaged in a covered call program is going to be a slow-rising market, the market in which you're getting upside, but it's happening on a gradual basis, which means you have the upside, you have the dividends, and you have the covered call premiums. What can be somewhat counterproductive is similar to what I mentioned back in 2016, when you have a real surging market over a short burst, because you're not going to participate in all of that. You're going to have stocks getting called away. 2013, 2017, and 2019 were great, strong markets, but we were able to capture most of that upside because they took place over a 12-month period, not a two-month period. So for us, a good, slow, steady, increasing market is probably the best market. And a market like we saw in February and March that goes down 35% over a 3.5-week period, even though we did much better relative to a long-only strategy, I don't think any of us would like to see that again.
Kevin, for our listeners to learn more, how can they contact you? Your phone number, email, web address?
Well, Mike, it's better if they call you. You know, our firm, Capital Wealth Planning, we love working with clients, but we work with clients through financial advisors. So our strategy is 5-star rated by Morningstar. We have well over $2 billion in our portfolio. We're thrilled. And if you go to capitalwealthplanning.com, you can absolutely get information about our firm and our strategies. But accessing us or engaging us is something that's going to be done through your financial advisor. And that allows us to really focus on what we're good at, which is managing portfolios and partnering with great financial advisors around the country.
And for those orphan referrals that go directly into Capital Wealth Planning, just know, Kevin, you can always send them over to me. I'd be happy to work with them.
Please call Mike Anderson. He's our go-to man in Beverly Hills, and we think the world of him.
Thank you, Kevin, and thanks so much for sharing the detail of this very effective best of breed equities income generating strategy for investors. I wish you the best of success with your efforts into the future.
Thanks, Mike. I look forward to coming back and we can talk after the election and chat about volatility and the post-corona world. Let's get back to normal, right?
Oh, I would love to have you back at that time. I'd love to have you back. Thank you, Daryl Wayne, engineer, Mark Allen, producer. I'm Mike Anderson, and this is the Anderson Files on podclips.io. Keep calm and keep listening.
You've been listening to the Anderson Files with Mike Anderson. Visit us at podclip.io and check on the financial box for more information on the Anderson Files.